The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I want to say one more thing. We mentioned the danger of, when a city is a religious center, a center of religious power, it's often very, very difficult to see the churches grow there. On the other side, though, is this. If you have very great church growth in those kinds of cities, in those centers of power, they can have tremendous effect on church growth all around the city. So it may be hard to see churches grow there, but if they do grow, then because of that city's power impact, that will have tremendous influence on other cities and on the rural areas as well. And I think the most powerful example of that is the day of Pentecost. You think of the impact of church growth on the gospel at Pentecost. Here's Jerusalem. Here is the center of religious power. Now the Holy Spirit comes, and in one day, after one sermon, suddenly the church experiences, I can't figure out how much 100% growth, from a little group of 12 to 300, and then how many more beyond that? How many heard the gospel of Pentecost?
3,000.
And then, as you read the book of Acts, then the church spreads out. The disciples are persecuted, and the gospel pushes outside of the city. But the change in the city of Jerusalem has tremendous effect on the church around the world. I think it's a good example of this. When you think of China today, you think of this tremendous growth of, or at least this, the more we're hearing more about the church in China. And a lot of that started when was it? Carter first made, treaty with the People's Republic. Nixon did too. And as a result of those signing of those treaties, Beijing allowed public worship, for open public worship. And when Beijing allowed it, bang, suddenly new churches were opening up everywhere. So if you can touch the key city, you can also touch other places as well, because the power moves from those key cities.
I have one question. Would you characterize Peking as a religious city? Definitely when
forbidden
city at that time probably religious, but
yeah.
They completely regime.
Not now.
Not.
But it's still, it would still be a city of political power. And sometimes it's not necessarily religious power, but political power also that has effect. That's. Sometimes I do think, though, that even today, Beijing may have, a lot of its power may still be religious, even though it claims to be non-religious. There's a book, Sociology of the City, by two men, John Spates and James Massionis. It's a very good standard text on urban sociology. And in the book, he has a history of different cities. And he has a very interesting history of Beijing. He has a beautiful diagram of the Purple City. And he points out the changes since Mao took over in China. And he comments on how the names of some of the streets have been changed, the purpose of the city has been changed. But even then, with all the names changed, in many ways the city still functions as an ideological map of the new China. So the in that sense, the power, even though it has been operated under Mao, it still has those religious reflections. It's the city still demonstrates the faith commitment of Marxism in China. It's very interesting.
Peking is a city, and Shanghai is a city too, but Shanghai's population-wise is much larger than Peking. But in terms of influence and power, Peking has more. So how you view these two cities? So just so you mentioned that when churches in Peking is opened up, then other churches also.
What would be some of the, what is Shanghai known for today? Years ago, before Mao, it was known also as a great city of commerce and trade. So it's still the same. Yeah. It would seem to me that in a city like Peking, Beijing, which has whose power is more political, there is where there may be more resistance on the one hand, and also if that center can be touched for Christ, there can also be more influence or impact coming out of that city than from Shanghai. That's what we're seeing.
But the thing is that sometimes economy is also very important. Economy is also related.
Yes.
Shanghai is a commercial city, economy-wise, is very affluent. I think money itself is also powerful. Would that also have a great impact with like a commercial city, great economy like Shanghai? Often, or with it also very resistant to the gospel because of its wealth?
That's true. I agree. I don't disagree.
So here, the rest of the issue. Say, if we want to do urban mission, so we should target which city is more, you know, more influential. So if we touch that city, probably powerful.
Yes. Yeah. But what I'm trying to warn against in terms of strategy is it can be a city like Beijing can be more difficult to target than another city. Because if the city has great power, like Beijing, and if it's using that power largely to protect itself against any change, it will be very resistant to the gospel. It will be very resistant to seeing churches starting. If a church does start there and grows, it can be very influential, like we're seeing now. But ordinarily, that's not the best place to begin starting churches. I would go to smaller cities, to cities that did not have as much wield as much power, have as much influence. And then what might happen with immigration, you're going to get Christians from that smaller city. They'll go to the larger city, and bridges will begin to take place. But don't start where the opposition may be the strongest. Start in smaller places. And like we were saying too, sometimes also in smaller cities, there is less connection to the center. So in the People's Republic, so many of the house churches and churches like that have started far away from central places of power. They're not as they're not as easily observed, and there's more openness, more opportunity for change. But this is why cities as places of power, you have to watch very carefully. I was thinking of this, I was going through all of the different places, on the other hand, where cities as places of power can be very influential. For example, church history is full of examples of great impact of the gospel through cities. The British Islands became Christian very early in their history, and they became Christian when when the king, as the power symbol, became converted. And then the king said, let's all become Christians. Bang, it happened. Or in Scandinavia, Norway, Sweden, all kinds of stories. The queen, is it Christina, becomes a Christian. And then she asks that all her subjects become baptized and become believers. And they all do. Now, in the past, we've looked at that history and said, it must be very superficial. But history has said, no, it's not superficial at all. McGavern has pointed out these have been very genuine people movements that have come to Christ. And in fact, people movements that are more stable than sometimes individuals coming to Jesus one at a time. They have been, for example, large movements that have drawn the poor into the church, when otherwise the poor would not come. And but they have come because of the impact of this one source of power on a large group of people. So it can, we're saying here it can also have great influence and impact. Another sample that came to my mind is the Reformation. The Reformation of the 16th century was an urban movement. There were, in the days of the Reformation in Europe, there were 65 official cities of the Roman Emperor, of the Roman Empire, 65. By the end of the 16th century, 50 of the 65 imperial cities had declared in favor of the Reformation. They either supporting the Reformation permanently or at least periodically. In Germany, some of the largest cities became overwhelmingly Protestant. Nuremberg, Strasbourg, Augsburg, all of them with populations in excess of 25,000 people, which was very large for Europe in those days. They became overwhelmingly Protestant. From the cities, the gospel spread. The city's impact as a center of power touched the smaller cities and the rural areas.
Do you think as a general principle, do you think it would be right to say we should look first at cities which are trade and commerce centers before we look at centers of kind of intellectual and cultural prowess? And I'm just thinking, in a trade center, there is a lot more movement in and out. There's in a way, there's less kind of stability or stagnation, if you can call it that.
I don't know the answer to that. There's another factor here that I'd like to touch in a moment that changes a little bit. See, part of the reason I'm struggling with that kind of answer, Andre, is that the gospel, when the gospel comes to a city for the first time, and when it walks into a city where they've never heard it before, it comes at people, not necessarily usually as a new economic idea, a new political idea, it's a new sort of cultural or social idea. It involves a whole new way of understanding family relationships, whole new way of understanding society. And it may touch the city on that first level. It may first touch the city on that particular level, then it penetrates. But I'm not sure that it would it have that much, would it touch that well if the city was not so much political or ideological as it was economic. I'm not sure. Please, Woody.
One of the clues might be Paul's methodology of going to the city, where he not only went to the synagogue, but he went to the marketplace, which was the center of the trade of ideas. That's where ideas entered. So it would seem that to follow that, a city which was more influential ideologically would be more important than one that was a trade center.
Yeah, but the thing is, when he goes to Athens, I mean, a few people are converted. And I was just thinking of a comment you made a couple of weeks ago about, I think it was in China, Confucianism. People who'd been influenced by Confucianism were very resistant to
the gospel, we're just animus to win. You know, it just strikes me that maybe, you know, when people have had a long time to kind of systematize their unbelief, if you can put it that way, it is a, you know, I don't know, maybe it's a lot more difficult to break into it. You know, whereas in a sort of a rapidly moving kind of sort of commercial or trade city, you know, maybe because there's less of that kind of, there's less room to kind of sort of sit and work out your your beliefs, there's less resistance to the gospel. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm just throwing that out.
Well, I'd suggest that two or three of you start some churches and then come back and let us know.
I also have a question. Talking about strategy of church growth, as you are saying, it would be more feasible to start a church at maybe a smaller city, not a little city. Is that a general rule, or it varies from country to country? Because, for example, if I go back to my country, you know, there are so many cities. In terms of the personal resource of the church, where should we invest some money in the personal? The capital city, or choose some smaller city? That's, I think, is that a general rule, or is that varies from country to country?
I wish there were a general rule.
isn't there another factor? You know, just that, again, I mean, there does seem to be, I mean, this, I know this is heresy in some quarters, but there is a special sense, in, you know, God does have a special concern for the poor and the underdog and the oppressed. I mean, I think I would rather start with a thriving commercial city which has got a massive squatter camps around it, you know, than go to, Cambridge, Massachusetts, you know, and try and plant a church amongst the intellectuals of the university. But
usually, I find that in many places, you know, the commercial city is not the capital city. But my question is that, where should we begin, you know, the secondary supply town, or the smaller city, or start with the capital city, you know?
I guess one of the things, I think, in order to answer that question, we have to recognize that cities are very different and that our countries are different as well. So that what may grow very powerfully in one country or area may not grow in another. That says to me, that lays on me the obligation of really trying to understand the particular area in which we are. We ought to have people involved in constantly putting the thermometer into the water and saying what's hot, what's cold, what's lukewarm. How do you do that? You look around, you don't have to have heavy examination, you follow your nose, and you ask around, where are churches growing? Maybe you find in a particular area, in a smaller city, you notice as you visit around, as you get reports in from churches, you notice that there seem to be more growing churches in one particular city than there is in another city. You visit those churches. You talk to the pastors, the leaders of the church. What are you doing here? What have you used that God is blessing? Do you think there's a reason why, have you noticed that the churches in this particular city seem to be growing faster than the churches in that city? Why is that so? What's the reason for that? Why do you think? Then you listen carefully and you start putting things down on paper. Very soon, very quickly, you find a pattern beginning to come up. And you don't need to do 8 years of study to find it. These are things you hear as you go to church meetings and two or three pastors are sitting around a table drinking tea together and they're talking about what they've seen in their city, and you're listening trying to get ideas. I think it can happen that way. But once you find that place where there seems to be genuine growth, what you need to do is find out why. Then you have to ask hard questions. People will say, oh, God's blessing us. Well, good, that's good. Why is God blessing you? Why is God blessing you this way in this city, but I see the same kind of enthusiasm for Christ in this other city, but God isn't blessing that one? Well, that's His sovereign will. No. I've got to try to understand as much as I humanly can What is the Lord using in these places? And I guess this is sort of like what Dr. McGavern has said many times. We need church growth eyes. Maybe we need church growth ears. Maybe we need urban church growth eyes and ears. So that when we go to those meetings and we hear stories, we're constantly sifting this information. We're trying to put it together, make it fit pieces. And we're constantly asking ourselves, what picture's coming out of here? What's going on here? Why is God doing this? What are those things that the Lord is using to cause this church to grow? I think, for example, that one thing that has been pointed out that I think Andre has said that's, to my mind, very crucial to a strategy. What is God doing for the poor? I think as a rule of thumb, you'll very often find, at least in the countries from which most of us come, that the fastest church growth often will take place among the poor. And very often we may find that the reason churches aren't growing is because they're aiming at the wrong and different groups of people. The poor, forget the theology, just think purely in terms of strategy. The poor form the largest group of people in any city. I've just been reading a new book. I finished it in a day and a half. I recommend this book, a very interesting book, by a Roman Catholic scholar, Aylward Shorter. It's called The Church in the African City. Just a brand new book. Aylward Shorter, S-H-O-R-T-E-R. He's written 6 or 7 books on African studies, Andre. Very gifted African theologian. He's Roman Catholic. And this is a brand new book, just published a month ago, I think, by Orbis. The first 4 or 5 chapters are his study of what is the African city like. And the last, it's a total of 11 chapters. It gets very frustrating near the end because he deals so much with Roman Catholic churches. A lot of the parish programs and all. But at the same time, I think he has a lot of very good ideas that we can transpose into our Protestant and evangelical communities. But very worth reading. In any case, one of the points he makes, one of the opening chapters, is that in so many countries of Africa, his figure is very, very large. He makes a big generalization, something like in his experience, over 60% of all urban dwellers in Africa are poor. And the middle class in a typical African city today constitutes no more than 10 to 15% of the population. And then there's the upper class. Now, given that statistic alone, whatever you think about what the Bible says about the poor, that says to me, you're awfully stupid people if you don't try to evangelize the poor. Because this is simply the largest single category of people that live in that city. And from this group, everything else being equal, this group would be moving up to form the middle class. Something which I think is very characteristic of the church anyway. I suspect part of the reason we have a growing middle class in so many countries today is because we have a growing church. But in any case, it's a very interesting book to read. Gives you a lot of challenging ideas, I think. I was going to give you one more sample of this same kind of thing, if I may. This is, I think, very interesting. A couple of things from Latin America. I was with, about a year ago with a group of missionaries from one denomination. I was in Mexico, and we were talking about church planting. And we were just several days on church planning and missions, and we had a lot of discussion about the city. And I was fascinated to hear that several of the missionaries were urging that from now on in church planting, that they ought to think seriously about putting at least one large congregation in every city they were going to. And they were talking about how their present policy had been to start little chapels, maybe in the suburbs, away from the center of the city. But they said the problem with this is that for many of the Latinos, the Latin Americans, if you plant a little something out in the suburbs with no building, this isn't really church. That for the Latino, what is church is that great big cathedral right there in the front by the plaza where everybody comes, the one that's been there for 100 years. That's church. And if you don't have that, that's not church. So the Protestant suffers under this tremendous barrier of not being able to put up those buildings. And the missionaries were saying, if we're going to see significant church growth in the future, we're going to have to think seriously about putting up those kinds of cathedrals. Not all over, but as it were there to have some kind of symbolic significance in Latin America. Here, a large church speaks to people symbolically of a new center of religious power, as it were. And that makes a lot of sense. So we need cathedral-type churches as well as small household churches. If the Latin American is to recognize the presence of the Protestant church, the Protestant church also is going to have their cathedral equivalents, their dynamic equivalents.
Okay. So are you saying that in the Jerusalem city there's the temple?
Yeah.
So something like that. Religious power.
Power center. And there's also synagogues too, scattered throughout the Middle East. But there's only one temple.
I think that's true, you know. And, I remember one of the, now he's teaching at Regent College, he's a scholar in the Chinese philosophy. He once visited the Nietzsche temple, a very beautiful Buddhist temple in our country. He said, the church should also build up big churches. There's still beautiful church in order to attract people, because yeah. The temple is attractive to a lot of people. But my reservation is that this is, in terms of strategy, is the pragmatic approach.
Yeah.
But that finally also shaped the theology of the Christians that we are going to land. But that's my only reservation. What do you say about that? If he said, then in the end, definitely the church member would say, we need big church.
Yes.
Would be a more proper place.
Yeah.
I think that's
the danger of arguing that way. The one interesting exception to this, or the one of the most interesting models of this, is in Latin America, is in Lima, Peru. And I was going to mention this now. The Christian and Missionary Alliance has built in Lima, Peru, a church like the one I was just talking about. The Christian Missionary Alliance was in Peru for about 50 years. And the efforts of that church were largely oriented to the rural people. The church was not a large church. In 1958, the Christian and Missionary Alliance planted their first church in Lima. It was called the Lunce Congregation. And growth continued to take place in Lima, but it was very slow, but it was growth, slow but steady. Finally, in 1970, the members of the congregation met together. They had an opportunity to buy, their building was getting filled, and they now began to talk about maybe getting a new piece of land and a new building. And so they began to talk about buying a piece of land alongside one of the main streets going into Lima. And they decided that they would that maybe they would try to build a cathedral-type church on the main street so that people going and coming into Lima would constantly be seeing that cathedral-type church. Now, this was 1970. The congregation then was only about, I think it was 350, 400 people. So they said, let's build a building for 500 people. Then others began to talk and they said, no, let's build a congregation for 1,000 people. Well, where do you get the money to build a congregation, a building for, to see the 1,000 when you have 300? They went to North America. They got money from an American businessman, a Christian in Texas, and with that money they began their building project. By 1973, they had 250 members. 1973. By 1982, they had 5,250 members in about 10 years. Now, directly related to it, they have planted more and more churches in Peru. This has become a mother church for at least four more congregations than I know of. National church growth as a whole. 1973, the total amount of members in the CNMA in Peru, 2,500, 1973. 1982, 10,000. Not just one congregation now, but the denomination as a whole has grown five times as large in 10 years. And this growth, the missionaries are saying, is directly traced to the building of this congregation. A large number of daughter churches, now even granddaughter churches, have been born. And this is interesting, they have been born in rural areas and in poor areas. A great many of the members of this church are not rich and wealthy, they are very poor. So the church, by building the cathedral church, they have reached the rural areas, and they have also been able to reach the poor. The congregation itself is basically middle class, but it has a larger number of poor than it did before. And a good number of the daughter churches are now oriented to the poorer cities. If some of you want to read this about this, the very first issue of Urban Mission, September 1983, has an article on this church in Lima. It's called Growth Through Evangelism in Lima, Peru, written by Fred Smith. And this is very interesting because the January issue of Urban Mission coming up, it has another essay by Fred Smith on the Lima church 10 years later. So it's going to be very interesting to compare what they did then with what's going on now. And he's still very enthusiastic for this kind of model. But to my mind, it's a very powerful example of how a church deliberately decided to build a cathedral-type church, bigger than they ever could handle. They had to have outside money. Part of it also was not just the building. The Christian Missionary Alliance has a very strong emphasis on prayer, strong emphasis on evangelism. So they didn't just put up a building. With it, they planned a very vigorous program of evangelism. They ran crusades, a program they started up in other CMA churches too, the Encuentro con Dios, Encounter with God movement, they called it. They pressed evangelism for this long period of time. Another factor, they organized very carefully prayer cell groups so that people were praying seriously about this growth. And a third factor, I think this is also crucial, they decided when they put this building up that they would put into these places the very best, the most capable leaders of the CMA churches in Peru. So they didn't just leave these churches to anybody who wanted to do it. They deliberately handpicked those servants in the church that they knew had special gifts for evangelism and leadership. And they took them out of their present churches and put them into these new works. So there were a number of different factors here, not just the building, a number of things. But I do think this idea of that cathedral type thing, and here they're in the capital city. Here's the place where people are coming and going past this building all day long. Here is the visible symbol of power in the city, now power in Christ. What's happening now is that this is so typical. Somebody sees something happening like this and they say, oh, let's try that. So here's, you know, here's Mr. Here's Paul Cho's church in Seoul. Ah, this will work beautifully. Let's try this. So we'll go to Taiwan and start something. Well, you know, we'll go to Taichung and start some big thing just like this cathedral, and it doesn't work. Well, we'll try this in Buenos Aires, and it doesn't work there either. There's always a danger in modeling. In this new essay coming out, Fred Smith comments on how this model has been used by CMA in different countries of the world. And he points out it doesn't work, always work the exact same way in different countries. He warns against the danger of trying to always take this model anywhere you go.
Is it another sort of case of understanding the meaning of a cultural form, or the meaning of a form in a particular culture? And I'm just thinking in a place like France, maybe a big cathedral points to the corruption of the church and salting away the wealth of the people.
Right. And it may, for example, if a place like Mexico, where you have very anti-priest, priestly movements, I think the same thing might hold true there too. Tied in with that, just recently, I've been corresponding with missionaries of the Presbyterian Church in America, in France, and they have had a team there for some time, many of them working in Marseille and Paris, and the work has been very slow and very difficult. Recently, one of the missionaries wrote me a long letter, and he said, he telephoned me from Paris. It always frightens me. And he said, Harvey said, you ever heard of Ralph Nader? And, well, I said, yes. He said, have you read his book on church growth? I had not read his book. So he said, look, if you would you be willing to read his book and answer some questions for us? And so we'll send you a free copy of the book. So I said, sure. The book arrived 2 days later. And he had it in his letter. He had a list of about 8 or 9 questions. But what they were trying to figure out an answer for is, will this model that Ralph Nader creates, will it work in Paris? That's basically what they're asking. And he had, in the book they're referring to, which is a very helpful book, by the way, it's called Where Do We Go From Here? And it's a very practical book dealing with how to set up house churches, small cell groups. And I told them that I thought it had many, many advantages. And about after they got my letter, I also said it has disadvantages. A good seminary professor. And he called me up and he said, fine. He said, we want you to know we're going to use this model in France. So it's going to be very interesting to see what they do with a model that deliberately avoids talking about congregations any larger than 20 to 25 people. They're going to have small cell groups. But his feeling was very strongly that in France, that's the way it's got to go. Just because of, partly I think, because of his understanding of the French mentality. So different situations going to call for different ways of doing it.
Well, that's interesting. It's very interesting to me personally. In that my church in South Africa has just recently finished a building. We were meeting in a school hall, and I hear that since, you know, after this, the building was only finished after we left, and apparently since the building has gone up, it's been quite a lot of church growth. And it's particularly interesting for me in that I remember my pastor saying that it was important to put a building there because, you know, it was just a sign to people in the neighborhood that we were there to stay. And we weren't just some little fringe group. And I can just see it kind of provides an avenue for me to kind of, you know, I know my church is going to be very resistant to this way of thinking. You know, it's a very reformed church. And I think they would sort of see this as kind of undermining the sufficiency of Scripture. You know, just this point, I mean, I can say to my pastor, you know, well, remember what you said about the building. It's just an example of the way we need to positively use that kind of sociological information.
It could be very valuable.
I think your conception about the growth of the church is going by the context, practice, and by the salvation of individual. What is the growth of the church? How can we define the growth of the church? First of all, the church, we have to understand the church growth in the context of the practice, not based on theology. There are a lot of phenomena that which cannot be understood by the theology. And then you mean the genuine Christian? Genuine Christian means who experiences the regeneration. I mean, the growth of a church is presupposed by the first of all the practice, and the secondary by the salvation of individuals.
Yeah.
Even so, we can find the church growth in the poor area, but anyway, your conception that is not presupposed by middle class consciousness or any ideology, just regeneration and the practice.
Well, boy, I think we have to all admit that our concepts of how we approach any issue, church or anything else, are going to be controlled by our ideologies. I'm not without ideologies. No one in this room is without ideologies. How would I understand church growth? Well, I think you can understand it two or three. I think you might say it has at least three different components when you think of church growth. You think of church growth in quantity. That is, more people becoming Christians. Churches that had 10 members having 20 members. Churches with 20 members having 22 members. That's church growth. So it's quantitative church growth. It is also qualitative church growth. It is not just adding numbers. Church growth is nurturing believers to grow in their understanding of what the gospel is, to grow in their understanding of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, growing in their relationship with the Lord. So it's quantitative, qualitative growth. It is also, I think, I don't know a word for this, it's also community-oriented growth. That is to say, it seems to me as the church grows, it grows because it has its relationship to the community or the people that it serves is also significant. And I'm trying to account in this definition for the fact that so often when people think about church growth, they only think about salvation of individuals. And I think the growth and life of the vitality of the church also is counted by our relationships with the community that we serve. How is the church serving its community? What are we doing to minister to the people that surround us? If you have a church that is not tied in to its community, its church growth will suffer in a very crucial area. I don't know what you call that, community-oriented or organic growth, but it seems to me that's also a very important part. You may not be able to number that kind of growth or count it, but it is very significant for understanding the life of the church, the vitality of the church. And I think there's where we see again the importance of reaching out to minister to the weak, to the helpless, to the poor. That's another way in which the church displays its vitality and its growth.